2005, something very unusual happened on Wall Street. A group of retired executives of Morgan Stanley challenged the CEO, Philip Purcell. They believed that the culture of the House of Morgan was something that was so special that it was worth saving, and that Phil Purcell was undermining it.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Glad to see all of you out this afternoon. Patricia Beard writes some of my favorite kinds of stories and books. She examines the world of privilege and, in a couple of cases, has documented the downfall of the rich and powerful. Patricia Beard is a graduate of Bryn Mawr College. She served as an editor-at-large of Elle magazine, as a feature editor of Town and Country, and has written literally hundreds of newspaper and magazine articles. She wrote a biography of Christy Todd Whitman, and I would say deliciously, she wrote After the Ball, Gilded Age Secrets, Boardroom Betrayals. Most recently, she's written Blue Blood and Mutiny, The Fight for the Soul of Morgan Stanley. Please welcome Pat Beard.
Thank you, George, and thank you all for coming. In 2005, something very unusual happened on Wall Street, something, in fact, that had never happened before. A group of retired executives of Morgan Stanley, arguably the most prestigious investment bank on Wall Street, this group included the former chairman and the former president of the firm, challenged the CEO and chairman, Philip Purcell. None of them wanted his job, and none of them were accusing him of illegal activities. So while there had been challenges on Wall Street to get rid of the heads of firms, and we've just seen a whole bunch of them, Philip Purcell was neither failing in a traditional sense, nor was he a crook, nor did anybody who was challenging him want his job. The reason that the challenge took place was that the people who were part of this group of eight, most of whom were old enough to collect Social Security and some of whom were in their 70s, had built the modern Morgan Stanley. They believed that the culture of the House of Morgan was something that was so special that it was worth saving and that Phil Purcell was undermining it. In addition to that, the performance of the firm was, in many instances, was, as Purcell described it himself, middle of the pack. The Morgan culture goes back 150 years. So by the time Phil Purcell came into the firm in 1997, the firm had been going on, well, for more than 150 years, because J.P. Morgan came to the United States as a second-generation financier in 1857. By the turn of the century, he'd founded the great trusts that included United States Steel. It included International Harvester, which had 85% of the farm equipment, made 85% of the farm equipment sold in the United States. And he had saved one-third of the railroads, which had had to be reorganized during the Depression of 1893 to 1897. He had saved the gold standard. He helped finance the British in the Boer War, which was 1899, for which he was rewarded by King Edward VII in the way that modern monarchs reward people, not the old-fashioned way of giving somebody a duchy or a large piece of jewelry, but by inviting him to dinner and seating him on his right. So J.P. Morgan was one of the great financial figures. He was certainly the best-known financial figure in the United States. Along with Henry Ford and Rockefeller, the name of Morgan was the great name in America, in the American industrial, the height of the Industrial Revolution. In 1907, something rather interesting happened, which led to regulation of the markets, and it involved Morgan directly. And it also is very similar to what has just happened on Wall Street today. The stock market was collapsing. Trust companies had backed loans with securities that were in danger of failing. There was a run on the banks, which was an early version of the recent run on Bear Stearns, almost exactly a century later, which shows that history doesn't necessarily teach its lessons as well as it might. But in 1907, there was no government entity to save the banks and their depositors. So Morgan called together a group of bankers at his house in New York. He sat in the library while they worked it out in another room. And basically, he said, you can't leave until you've sorted something out. He persuaded them to put up $25 million to cover the trust company's calls and averted a national economic collapse. Now, that was 1907. It was clear from that and other such events that it was probably not such a good idea to have that kind of power in private hands. Although, of course, this was good what he did, but it could have been bad. So by 1913, the first of the great regulatory agencies was established, and that was the Federal Reserve. There were hearings in Congress called the Peugeot investigation of what was called alleged to be the Money Trust by the House Banking and Currency Committee. And when J.P. Morgan testified, there was a famous interchange on the stand, which became part of the culture and legend of the Morgan firms. The committee counsel, Samuel Untermeyer, asked Morgan if he used money or property as collateral. And Morgan said, no, sir, the first thing is character. Untermeyer said, before money or property? Morgan said, before money or anything else, money cannot buy it. J.P. Morgan died that year. The Federal Reserve was established at the end of the year. And a few years later, when the firm J.P. Morgan built its office, the famous corner at 23 Wall Street, the character statement was set in the cornerstone of the building by his son, Jack Morgan. Now, interestingly, the idea of reputation and integrity, all the details of that haven't come out. And I had the great pleasure of spending quite a lot of time in the basement of the Morgan Library looking at Jack Morgan's papers. This was, in fact, a diversion because I couldn't get the members of the Group of Eight who had challenged Phil Purcell to talk to me for the first 4 months during which I was supposedly writing this book. So I had to do something else. And what I did was I spent my time trying to figure out what they were fighting for. That was actually quite a good thing. I found a memorandum in Jack Morgan's private papers, which I've never seen published elsewhere. And what he told President Wilson when he met with him in July 1914 was that the Peugeot investigation, that was the investigation which led to the Federal Reserve being established, was offered to us for $40,000 by underground channels, but we had never bought anybody yet and did not propose to begin. The purpose of that meeting was to figure out what J.P. Morgan and Company could do to help the Allies before the United States got into the war. And over the next couple of years, the Morgan firm was the buying agent for the French and the British, contracting more than $3 billion in goods. And when we got into the war, Morgan was in the forefront of floating $1.2 billion in bond issues. In a New Yorker profile, the writer claimed, "The war helped Morgan and Company, and Morgan and Company, more than any other firm, saved the Allies." So by the middle of let's say 1920, what you could say is that J.P. Morgan had retained its reputation as being the most powerful banker in America, one of the most powerful banking firms in the world. It was still very small. In 1933, when the Depression hit, there was a major reaction against Wall Street. Bankers started being called banksters. The reference was to Al Capone, who had been convicted of tax evasion in 1931. His takings were about $100 million, which were tens of millions more than J.P. Morgan himself had in his estate in 1913. In any case, at that point, the banksters were hauled before the Senate Banking and Currency Commission, and the council was a man called Ferdinand Pecora, who is a former New York City district attorney. He was a precursor of Elliot Spitzer in the sense that he hated Wall Street and he was going to get him. And he tried, but I have to say he didn't quite succeed. Even Pecora admitted that when Jack Morgan entered the hearing room, he wrote, public interest was almost hysterically intense. The night before the hearings, Morgan sat down in his hotel room and with a pencil and a piece of paper, he wrote down a statement, which is in the introduction of my book, Blue Blood and Mutiny. And the gist of it, the sentence, which has become the mantra and the motto of the House of Morgan, was at all times the idea of doing only first-class business, and that in a first-class way has been before our minds. To this day, there are people in the various Morgan firms, of which there is more than one, who have that statement framed on their walls. I've been in lots of offices by now at J.P. Morgan and some at J.P. Morgan Chase, and there it is. Everybody has a different version of it. Sometimes, you know, sometimes it's in calligraphy and sometimes it's just typed out and so on, but there it is. And that summer, after the Pecora hearings, Tom Lamont, who was one of the great J.P. Morgan partners, sent a private memorandum to his other partners. And in it he wrote, a mysterious sort of glamour seemed to attach to the firm and possibly added to its influence. Again, there was a sense that there was too much power in too few hands. So in 1933, the Glass-Steagall Act was passed, and it required that banking institutions choose between commercial and investment banking. J.P. Morgan had done both. But during the Depression, there weren't all that many firms that were looking to raise money. So J.P. Morgan decided it would be a commercial bank. It stopped being an investment bank. And the consequence of that was that there were some very talented investment bankers working there who didn't have very much to do. 2 years later, I should also mention that in 1934, the SEC was created to enforce securities law. So in those 2 years, two very major and influential acts and laws were passed, which would govern the way banking was done over the next 50 years. More than 50 years. Meanwhile, investment banking still had to be done. And by 1935, interest rates were low, and some of the J.P. Morgan clients were looking to raise money. But they couldn't go to J.P. Morgan to do it. So they said, well, would you lend us some people who could come and show us how to do these public issues? And some of the J.P. Morgan partners who didn't have enough to do said, we think maybe we can do better than that. They wrote something called the XYZ, the outline of the XYZ Corporation, and they met in North Haven, Maine, to discuss what to do. There were five of them who went up to Tom Lamont's farm, which is called Sky Farm. Now, this is an interesting thing about the House of Morgan, and it'll bounce back at us when I talk about the Group of Eight again, which is the firm was so private, when something important had to be discussed, it was often discussed in somebody's home rather than in the office, even though the office was small and there weren't that many partners. So you can imagine in the summer of 1935, it's August, it's hot, nothing's air conditioned. These five guys come up on the overnight train from New York to Maine. Then they go by the power launch to North Haven and they go to Tom Lamont's house. And there they sit on the 100-foot long porch. I know it's 100 feet long because I went there the summer before last to see it, and I paced it off, and my feet are almost a foot long. And I imagine these men sitting there, and in those days, regardless of the weather, men wore coats and ties and Panama hats and so on, sitting in those wonderful Adirondack chairs looking out over Penobscot Bay and saying, we're going to start a new firm. Well, among them was a man called Parker Gilbert, Jr., who was a lawyer, and he was a partner at J.P. Morgan. Harold Stanley, who was one of the great investment bankers of the era. Harry Morgan, who became the other named partner of this new firm, wasn't there. He was rarely there. He was in England for the grouse season, and he spent about half his time in England. But there had to be a Morgan in any Morgan firm, or the firm could no longer use the name of Morgan. So what happened was they determined that they would start a firm, and they did. And a month later, this is the way things were done in those days, a month later, 18 office boys rolled the roll-top desks that were famously the desks at which the Morgan partners sat down Wall Street from J.P. Morgan to 23 Wall, from 23 Wall to Morgan Stanley at 2 Wall, and the partners sat down at the desks and started to do business. Morgan Stanley had a call on $7.5 million in capital. That's it, from the Morgan and Lamont families. J.P. Morgan, by contrast, had $340 million in capital. It was a pretty small firm. The name partners, Harold Stanley and Harry Morgan, led a group of, I think there were six of them all together. And in the first 3 months, they did a quarter of the Wall Street public offerings amounting to $1 billion in underwriting. And over the next few years, they managed 20% of Wall Street underwriting. Who were their clients? The old J.P. Morgan, the loyal J.P. Morgan clients, many of whom had firms which were started and originally financed by J.P. Morgan. I'm going to jump ahead. Morgan Stanley is not yet 20 years old. It has the same clients. It has the same capital, about $7.5 million. It has the same partners. And once again, after the Second World War, it's challenged by another government entity, this time the Department of Justice, in the form of a civil lawsuit, claiming that 17 investment bankings had violated the Sherman Act. The case was called USA v. Henry S. Morgan, Harold Stanley et al. None of the other investment banks were mentioned in the title of the case, an indication of who ruled Wall Street. If you weren't included in the case, it was very embarrassing because it meant that you weren't one of the most important. The judge, Harold Medina, presided. The case went on for almost 3 years. At the end, Medina ruled against the Justice Department and said that these firms had not acted in restraint of trade. And in 1954, he published a book about the case, citing Harold Stanley as one of his most credible witnesses. But he also said something which, again, became part of the Morgan Stanley legacy. Remember, we had the character quote from J.P. Morgan. We had the first-class business quote. Now we have Judge Medina, an outsider, saying the following. He spoke specifically about Morgan Stanley, but he also spoke about investment banking. And he said, "It would be difficult to exaggerate the importance of investment banking to the national economy. The growth of the past 50 years has covered the U.S. with a vast network of manufacturing and so on, smooth functioning of which is vital to our welfare as a nation. Adequate financing of their needs is the lifeblood of what he described as healthy, normal functioning." Into the 1970s, new hires at Morgan Stanley were strongly advised, as in handed a copy and told to read, what was called Medina. And those were the people, those new hires from the 1960s and 70s, who built the modern Morgan Stanley. And they are the people who, in 2005, would become the Group of Eight. The firm still wasn't growing much. In 1964, as it neared its 30th anniversary, Perry Hall, who was a recently retired chairman, sent a memo to his partners saying, "We should stay small and private. There's no need to increase our capital beyond $10 million. We should not enter the investment advisory business. If we merge, won't it look as though we needed to, felt weak, et cetera?" And then in capital letters, he wrote, "What is wrong with us now?" Well, what was wrong with them was they needed capital. It wasn't very functional to be a partnership because the partners could take out their capital at the end of each year. And so in 1970, Morgan Stanley entered the modern era. They incorporated to keep capital in the firm, and they started new businesses. And again, these businesses were started by the young business school graduates who would later, who would build the modern Morgan Stanley and who would later challenge Philip Purcell. They started mergers and acquisitions. They started, which they had never charged for before. They started research, equity sales and trading, private wealth management, international businesses. They'd never done much in the way of soliciting business. In fact, the joke about Morgan Stanley was that the phone rang coming in, but they didn't make outgoing calls. 15 years later, Morgan Stanley had its 50th anniversary in 1985, and they were doing extremely well. The revenues had risen almost 60% between 1984 and 85, and the firm took out a full-page ad in which they pledged to stay private. But a year later, with Parker Gilbert, the younger Parker Gilbert, as chairman, I'm going to go back in a second to his genesis, the management committee took its first vote ever. Previously, all decisions had been made on a consensus basis. If everybody couldn't come to a consensus, they simply didn't do whatever the deal was that they were thinking of doing. It was a culture of debate and discussion. They voted to go public in order to raise capital and continue to grow. The stock opened at 56.5, the day closed at 70. Now, I want to go back a little bit to Parker Gilbert. You remember the porch meeting. The first Parker Gilbert was the father of this Parker Gilbert who became the chairman of Morgan Stanley. He died when Parker was 4. Parker's mother married Harold Stanley, who was the first named partner of Morgan Stanley, the second named partner of Morgan Stanley. And Parker Gilbert's godfather was Harry Morgan. The blood of Morgan Stanley ran in his veins. But when the publisher proposed that we call this book Blue Blood and Mutiny, Parker Gilbert was very much against it. By this time, I had interviewed all the members of the Group of Eight and hundreds of other people. And I knew Parker relatively well. And he said, what's the title of this book going to be again? And I said, well, Blue Blood and Mutiny. And he said, that's not right. That's absolutely not right. He said, this is not a blue blood firm. This is a meritocracy. You're going to give people the wrong impression. I said, people already have the wrong impression. It wasn't my title. In fact, it was the publisher's title. I fought it. I happened to think he was right, because it is actually rather an enticing title. But I just want to talk about what the blue blood of Morgan Stanley really was for a minute. It really was a meritocracy. Of the six chairmen after Harold Stanley, every one of them except for Parker Gilbert was completely self-made. Frank Petito was the son of an Italian immigrant who worked as a janitor, went to Princeton on a scholarship. Bob Baldwin, grandson of a conductor on the Pennsylvania Railroad. Dick Fisher, who was a revered chairman, had polio at the age of 8, and it was recommended that he go to trade school because he couldn't get in and out of a regular public school fast enough. They wouldn't take him back. They said he could be a fire hazard. So his doctor recognized a talented little boy and said, no, this isn't right. Got him a scholarship to a private school. From then he went on to have a scholarship to Princeton, a scholarship to Harvard Business School, and made a great career. John Mack, the current chairman, who is the president under Dick Fisher, is the son of a Lebanese immigrant who started as a peddler, carrying whatever he was carrying, goods, on his back, and eventually owned a small wholesale grocery business in a tiny town in North Carolina, and John Mack went to Duke on a football scholarship. Now, by the 1990s, the men who built the modern Morgan Stanley were beginning to retire. And in 1997, the only ones who were left were of the major builders were Dick Fisher, who was chairman, and John Mack, who was president. Parker Gilbert was on the board. Meanwhile, in a very different culture, Philip Purcell was being trained for leadership. He came from Utah. He went to Notre Dame and Chicago Business School and so on. He lived in Chicago. He was a McKinsey guy for a few years, and then he was assigned to Sears. When he went to Sears, Sears was in terrible trouble. It was a time of paranoia and near panic. The retail business and the catalog business were failing. And the chairman, who was Purcell's mentor, a man called Edward Telling, ran a closed-door, top-down business, the opposite of Morgan Stanley. There was no debate and discussion. There was very low CEO visibility. The firm needed to diversify, and Purcell was perceived as being a great strategist, and Telling really liked him, so he hired him. Interestingly, there was a tall man culture at Sears. Telling was tall. Ed Brennan, who succeeded him, was tall. And Phil Purcell was 6'4". And they weren't the only ones, but that seemed to be something. There seemed to be some appeal of these tall men among themselves. In any case, Purcell came in, and they had a bunch of ideas about how to diversify. They thought they would become the great American company. So they were very cash rich, and they thought of acquiring John Deere, which wasn't interested, IBM, not interested, AT&T, not interested. Disney, they decided they weren't interested because Telling was nervous about Hollywood, even if it was Disney. Finally, they settled on Dean Witter, which was a brokerage firm in New York, which had started in California. And they bought Dean Witter. Sears bought Dean Witter in 1981. Purcell was 38 years old. He was quoted in the Wall Street Journal as saying, "There is no reason why someone shouldn't go into a Sears store and buy a shirt and coat and then maybe some stock." This became known as either Stocks and Socks or Socks and Stocks. I'm never quite sure which. But there were Sears booths in the stores, and they were manned for the most part by inexpensive and inexperienced salespeople. It was not a success. Ed Telling sent Purcell, then 38, to Wall Street as president of Dean Witter. Purcell had never lived in New York. He had never run a division, and he had no financial services experience. He also didn't want to live in New York, and his wife and six sons lived in a Chicago suburb, and Purcell commuted on the weekends. He eventually had a seventh son, so he obviously went home from time to time. Enter Morgan Stanley. In 1993, Socks and Stocks was a bad fit for Sears, and they decided to spin off Dean Witter, and Morgan Stanley was one of the underwriters. He gave the impression of being a really excellent guy. He was a good strategist. He was very bright. He had a nice laid-back Midwestern manner. He was tall. He had a low-key style, and Dean Witter was well-run and profitable. It also had assets under management that would have been complementary to Morgan Stanley. When they did the road shows for the public offering, he did a good job. He went out with Morgan Stanley people. It was good. And so there was some discussion of possibly acquiring Dean Witter themselves, of Morgan Stanley acquiring Dean Witter. But Dean Witter didn't want to be acquired. Purcell wanted to be on his own. And indeed he was, until 1997, when merger fever raged through Wall Street. And Morgan Stanley approached Dean Witter. At that point, Dick Fisher was chairman, John Mack was president. The negotiations were well underway for this merger when Purcell announced that he had some special terms. And this was either do it my way or no deal. The first was that he had to be the chairman and CEO. These two roles had never been combined at Morgan Stanley. There had been a chairman, but the CEO role was in fact played by the management committee. This was the debate and discussion culture that I mentioned earlier. John Mack was slated to become chairman. Fisher said to Mack, just say no, this is not good, you should be chairman. And Mack believed that it was best for the firm to do the merger. So he said, no, I think it's fine for Phil to be the chairman and CEO. We'll just have a handshake agreement that he'll turn it over to me in a couple of years. Now, anybody who knows much about mergers and acquisitions knows that one of the basic rules when you do what's called a merger of equals is that you don't have a handshake agreement. You write down succession. But they didn't write down the succession. So that was an issue that was waiting that was a boil that was waiting to burst, I'm afraid. The next rule was the 75% rule, which was to fire Purcell or Mack, 75% of the board had to agree. Both Mack and Purcell agreed to that. Dick Fisher and some of the M&A people at Morgan Stanley said, this isn't a good idea. If this is what he wants, he doesn't trust us. We shouldn't do this. John Mack was determined to do it. Dick Fisher thought it was fine also. Next was that the board was going to be 50-50. Half of the board was going to come from Dean Witter, half from Morgan Stanley. That was fine as long as they were two separate firms. When the firms merged, how are we going to decide who came from where? These were problems that were innate in the structuring of the merger. It still could have worked if Purcell and Mack had been able to get along. And if Purcell had understood the history and culture of Morgan Stanley, the Morgan Stanley people were so proud of their culture and so believed in it that they thought that they could, that Purcell and his people from Dean Witter would either want to learn to be like Morgan Stanley or that they could roll right over Purcell. They were wrong on both counts. A year later, Dick Fisher, who was still the chairman of the executive committee on the board, went to see Purcell privately. This is one of the things that happens occasionally to a writer, which is really exciting. You interview somebody a number of times, and eventually you gain that person's trust, and the person says, "I have something to show you that nobody else has ever seen." And someone gave me Dick Fisher's notes from his private files. After 1 year, he wrote notes about what he was going to say to Phil Purcell. He was going to ask Phil Purcell to step down as CEO. And the notes included some of these phrases: the firm is losing momentum, the people you're bringing in are not a meritocracy, decision making is too cautious, too long, constant seeking outside, you cannot fix it, John, Mac, is better suited to provide leadership. He will get even more out of your Dean Witter senior people. He advised Purcell to tell the board that Purcell wanted to remain as chairman and to turn over the CEO job to John, and that if Purcell didn't do it, he'd do it. Unfortunately, Dick Fisher had prostate cancer. He was being, in addition to having had polio and being having a hard time getting around, he was being treated with chemotherapy, and he never did approach the board members, to the best of my knowledge. Meanwhile, neither the cultures nor the systems were integrated. The board was now stacked within 2 years with former CEOs of manufacturing corporations. None of them lived in New York. None had financial services experience. Nominations went to Purcell first, and only if he approved, to the nominating committee. And people who ran within the firm who ran billion-dollar businesses were not invited to board meetings, so the board didn't know them. They were told not to contact them except through Phil Purcell. John Mack suggested that he go down to the World Trade Center, which was where the Dean Witter offices were, to run the retail division because he felt that it was important for him to get to know the part of the business that he hadn't known before. Phil Purcell said to him, "No, they'll think you're looking over their shoulders." That was the kind of thing that was going on. Well, finally Mack decided that first he proposed that he and Purcell be co-CEOs. That, of course, wasn't going to work. And then he decided he was not going to be able to make any headway, that he was going to resign. His entire career had been at Morgan Stanley. It was a very wrenching decision for him. And Dick Fisher advised him not to do it, but Mac was determined to do it, and Dick Fisher asked to see the board. At that time, Fisher was really having a hard time getting around. He was very under the weather from the chemotherapy and so on. And so he made up his mind that he would sit outside the boardroom so nobody could say, "It's too hard for Dick to get here. Let's not bother. It's too hard for him to get here." He sat outside the boardroom, and it is as though someone were sitting right outside those doors, and we were having a meeting in here, and he waited, and he waited. People passed him in the hall. There he sat with his crutches. And finally, Phil Purcell came out and he said, "I'm sorry, Dick, the board is not willing to see you." That story reverberated through the firm. It was so clearly against everything about the culture of Morgan Stanley, so disrespectful to a great leader of the firm. Even if he hadn't been a great leader, he'd been the chairman. In any case, Mac left. And he left just as the markets were falling around the ears of Phil Purcell. So Purcell found himself inexperienced in institutional securities with the big tech crash and having to deal with it without John Mack as the intermediary. What happened was that the firm did not recover as quickly as its core competition. And in addition to that, there was a continued drip, drip, drip of people leaving the firm, really talented people walking out. There was what a Fortune writer called a chorus of critics. Phil Purcell never gave interviews to the media, but he did give an interview to Fortune in the end of 2004, which ended with him saying, he gave it on the golf course actually, which ended with him saying, "Morgan Stanley doesn't have to do anything." Well, There was also the threat of a merger. He wanted to merge the firm. He wanted to merge with either Bank of America or Wachovia, cultures which are even less like Morgan Stanley than Dean Witter. Members of the on the institutional security side, members of the management committee, were very much against it. And the news leaked that this was happening, leaked out to the people who would become the Group of Eight. Finally, at the end of the year, Richard Bove, one of the top analysts on Wall Street, described the previous 10 years as the lost decade for Morgan Stanley. Dick Fisher died in December, and in January there was a memorial service for him. 1,500 people attended. Not a single member of the Morgan Stanley board came. It was understood that they had been told that it wasn't necessary for them to be there. 4 days later, at Parker Gilbert's apartment, three advisory directors met: Parker, the former president, Bob Scott, the former CEO, and Louis Bernard, the former CFO, and four members of the management committee in an ultra-private meeting. It took me 2 years to find out that this meeting had actually taken place after so many interviews with people. People come up and say, I think some people got together at Parker's. Well, when? Could you check your calendar? Doesn't seem to be on my calendar. Anyway, it went on like that for a while. Finally, I got it. There was that meeting. At the meeting, Parker said to these four members of the management committee who ran major businesses at the firm, what's really going on? We may have to do something. If we do, we will not tell you what it is. We don't want to jeopardize your jobs. We need clarity about what's happening at the firm. And they told him. When they left, someone said to the others, Phil has got to go. Now, the one thing nobody can remember is who said Phil has got to go. They all agreed. They started calling their colleagues. They formed a group of eight who pledged their support to the effort to get rid of Purcell. They planned to do it in the most private possible way, in keeping with the Morgan Stanley tradition. And they wrote a letter on March 3rd, which, as it happens, is my birthday, so it's one number I always remember in this story. On March 3rd, they sent a letter to all the members of the board and to Phil Purcell, in which they gave all the reasons why they felt that the firm was in the middle of the pack, that Purcell was failing as a leader, and that they needed to find a new head of the firm. Unfortunately, one of the things they also said in the letter was, since this is a letter to the board, they're trying to get on their side, and none of you have any financial services experience, and none of you live anywhere near New York. It would probably have been better if they had left that out. Well, weeks went by, and there was no response to the letter except for a couple of calls from individuals saying, we know you're going to leak it. When are you going to leak it? Are you going to leak the letter? The answer was, no, we're not going to leak the letter. All we want is a meeting. A couple of us and a couple of you, all of us and all of you. No, that's out of the question. On March 28th, something took place which is known as the Easter Monday Massacre. Vikram Pandit, who was the head of institutional securities, John Havens, the head of equities, and Steve Newhouse, the president, were fired. What's interesting is that Vikram Pandit is now the CEO of Citigroup. John Havens is now the head of investment banking at Citigroup. Steve Newhouse is not, in fact, active in business right now. But these were some of the most talented people on Wall Street, as you may gather from what happened to them a couple of years later. And Phil Purcell appointed two younger people, Zoe Cruz, former head of fixed income, a woman, and Steve Newhouse, to be co-presidents. That made Zoe Cruz one of the most powerful women on Wall Street, and in fact, she was described as ahead of Hillary Clinton in a list of the most powerful women in the world. And the sort of six ahead of her were the heads of states. After the firing took place, this group of ultra-private individuals decided to go public. They bought an ad in the Wall Street Journal. A page in the Wall Street Journal, you might be interested to know, cost $250,000. And they published essentially the contents of their letter. And the fight began. Now, Phil Purcell had quite a lot going for him. He had his board. It was too late for a proxy fight by the time this fight began, because the board meeting had in fact already taken place. I mean, the annual meeting had taken place. There was a year to go. He was in the seat of power. The institutional investors hadn't been complaining about the performance of the firm, and indeed they don't normally get involved unless there is a proxy fight. What the aid had going for them was reputations, their credibility with institutional investors, even after being retired for 10 years or more in some cases. Great belief in the cause, no jobs to lose, and they could afford to fight. They ended up spending $7.5 million. The media loved the story. They thought this was just a hoot. Here are these old guys. In fact, a number of them were younger than Phil Purcell, who was 63, but he started calling them grumpy old men, and pretty soon that caught on, and everybody started calling them grumpy old men. Belief in the cause, and no jobs to lose, and plenty of money to fight it. And Purcell went silent. Inside the firm, he claimed that they had, he talked a lot inside the firm, but not to the media. And he claimed that they had a great media organization. In fact, the way this fight was pursued was that every morning, the members of the Group of Eight would meet in a conference room in their advisor's office. And they, first they'd watch CNBC. Then they'd scan the newspapers to see what there was about them. Then they would report on the effect of their calls to the major institutional investors. Who did you speak to? What did they say? And what they'd heard from inside sources. This was the great media organization. They had one PR guy, a lawyer, and one other advisor. The way Purcell handled the challenge was indicative of his leadership style. And it was interesting to me because you could see how the culture of the Group of Eight worked. They sat around a table, they figured out what to do. What Purcell did was he became increasingly remote. And he wouldn't defend himself with the media. So there was a woman called Melissa Lee who worked for CNBC who actually interviewed me on CNBC when the book came out. And she would stand outside with a mic for practically 3 months outside the Morgan Stanley building saying, Phil Purcell, if you're up there, come down. CNBC will talk to you anytime. Meanwhile, things were happening. Top talent was leaving. Names you may or may not know, but Joe Perella, who was one of the great client bankers in the world, and certainly in the country, quit on the 13th of April, a couple of weeks after the fight. Terry McGee, who was his lieutenant, quit. They started their own firm. The major risk management team quit, very important to what would happen at the end of 2006 and 2007. Groups of 8 and 9 people were leaving to go to other firms, and of course, competitors were poaching like crazy, and this was in the newspapers all the time. And Purcell kept on saying, this is a personal attack on me, and it's the newspaper's fault. Every time somebody leaves, they report it. Well, sure. Meanwhile, Ronald Perlman was suing the firm for $2 billion. Purcell had brought in a bulldog lawyer, and the lawyer had said he wouldn't settle. And the case was handled so badly by Morgan Stanley that the Morgan Stanley legal counsel that the judge instructed the jury to assume Morgan Stanley's guilt and simply decide how much to fine them. As the fight was going into its third month, the jury decided to fine Morgan Stanley almost $2 billion. There was paranoia inside the firm. People believed the phones were tapped. There were cartoons about Morgan Stanley. Saturday Night Live did a skit about Morgan Stanley. The firm threatened to pull their ads if negative stories were scheduled in any of the major print media. And the Group of Eight led on that they were considering a proxy fight. Meanwhile, they had spoken to so many institutional investors that when Purcell called to speak to institutional investors, they would say, well, Will, listen, you can come, but you've got to bring a member of your board with you. Eventually, there was such leakage of talents, such terrible publicity, such a sense by the institutional investors that the Group of Eight were right and Purcell had to go, that they pressured the board to get rid of him. Purcell was hanging on by his fingernails, and the Group of Eight didn't know whether they were making progress or not. On May 20th, Purcell was in Tokyo speaking at an all-Asia video conference a couple of days after the Perlman fine had been announced. First, he claimed that the judge was prejudiced. He called her a rogue judge. Then he said that three of the juries were tampered with. Now, he's talking to 1,000 people, probably, by video conference, right? And then he said, the top priority for us in the U.S. is to get out of the newspapers. He claimed that the Group of Eight had lost credibility, And he said, to say negative things about the firm that made all of them rich, all the money they've made in the firm they've made since they retired, you made them rich. And for them to hurt the firm and hurt the share price, I just can't understand what kind of mind would do that. Well, the top priority was not to get out of the newspapers. The top priority for the board was to get rid of Phil Purcell. 2 weeks later, Purcell announced that he was retiring. He was paid $113.7 million to leave. The New York Times wrote one of its rare editorials about a Wall Street event of this sort, called The Wages of Failure on Wall Street. They called his departure package ludicrous, and failures rewards, and commented, few of life's losers land so affluently. Purcell insisted that the board not consider any members of the Group of Eight, anyone who had left, or John Mack to replace him. John Mack hadn't been involved in this fight. In fact, he had really stayed on the sidelines. Chuck Knight, who was a member of the board, speaking for the board, announced this to the media. A couple of days later, he was having dinner with John Mack in a private apartment at the Carlisle Hotel and saying, we think we'd like you to come back. There are a couple of directors there and John Mack and one other person on his side, so to speak, I guess his lawyer. And Chuck Knight said to him, John, you don't sound very excited about coming back. And John said, well, why should I? It's the same board that let me go. But he did come back. And on June 30th, the directors unanimously elected him chairman, and Mack was back. So Mack is back, and where is Morgan Stanley now? In 18 months, he turned around the most underperforming areas of the firm, and I'll give you a couple of highlights. And this is in the context of what we're all reading about, which is the subprime catastrophe. The two worst performing businesses, both old Dean Witter businesses, were Global Wealth Management, formerly known as retail. In 2 years, it was up 127% under James Gorman, whom Mack hired. The pre-tax profit, 21%, up from 2% in 2000 under Purcell. Asset management, up 29% in 2 years, with record results in 2007 under Owen Thomas, somebody who was already at Morgan Stanley, whom Mack promoted to run the division. The disastrous Perlman judgment was reserved by a new corporate counsel, Gary Lynch, whom Mack brought in. Mack offices opened new offices worldwide, even a small office in Kiev, responding to the firm's commitment to agricultural investments. In China, revenues have tripled since 2006. Morgan Stanley's number one in China-related international IPOs, the Middle East business grew 90% in 3 years. This is really good news. But there was a bad call, which is John Mack chose to keep Zoe Cruz, whom he had mentored in fixed income when he was at the firm, who was the only member of the institutional securities side of the firm who had stuck with Purcell and had done so in a, it wasn't just that she stayed with him, it was that she made some pretty strong statements against the Group of Eight. For some reason, Mack kept her. I don't understand why. I've got theories, but you know, I don't write about theories. I write about what I know happened. And Mack and Cruz were eager to move aggressively to make up for lost opportunities. Phil Purcell's greatest failure as the head of the firm, aside from the cultural issues, was that he was extremely risk averse. He hadn't been involved in this very profitable area of mortgage-backed securities. So in November, this last November, a desk that Zoe Cruz oversaw reported billions of dollars in subprime losses, and she was fired. The way it came about was that, in fact, Zoe Cruz and John Mack recognized that they were at the end of a cycle. They shorted subprime, decided to cover the interest on the short by going long. What they bought were swaps and derivatives, which were not, which could only be sold to the counterparty. The counterparty was Goldman Sachs, their rival. And when they decided they wanted to sell them back and get out of the position, it was basically too late. So they went in and they said, we'll sell them back to you. Let's say they bought them at 100. We'll sell them back to you at 60. Goldman said, no, they're worth 50. Oh, we better think about it a few days later. Okay, we'll take 50. Now they're worth 40 now. And eventually they were worth very, very little. They lost the money and she was fired. By the time they finished counting, they were about $10 billion in the hole. Mac had a policy, which was pay for performance. And he said, even though this was not his direct responsibility, the buck stopped with him, and he didn't take a bonus for 2007, which would have been some $45 million. An interesting story, and this goes back to the question of, does the Morgan Stanley culture survive, and what is it, is when he announced to the management committee that he was not going to take his bonus, after the committee meeting, one of the other members of the committee, who probably had a bonus in the tens of millions of dollars himself, came up to Mac and he said to him, John, you're doing the right thing. I'm not going to take a bonus either. And John Mac said to him, no, your division has outperformed anything we expected. Of course you're going to get your bonus. But it was a real indication that the partnership culture had never really gone away. The sense that they were all in it together remained an important sense that people wanted to go back to. Finally, people have asked me, what would have happened if Phil Purcell had never left Morgan Stanley? It's probable that their subprime exposure would have been minimal. Although it's certain that Zoe Cruz would have continued to press Purcell to take a more aggressive stand and to take more risks in mortgages and other collateralized debt obligations. But it's also certain that there would have been a continued bleeding of talent, morale, and an attenuation of the culture. And a couple of weeks ago, I asked somebody at Morgan Stanley, somebody in the top ranks, what he thought would have happened. And if Phil Purcell had still been there. And he said, well, if Phil were still here, we'd be Bank of America. That's it for now.
Well, it's a fascinating story, well told. I need to make a confession. I have never had a good original idea in my entire life. And so whenever we have a really outstanding forum speaker, you can bet your bottom dollar that the idea for the speaker came from a good friend of the Miller Center. And Pat Beard and her work was called to my attention by two good friends of the Miller Center, Antoinette and Ben Brewster, who are with us tonight. And please join me in thanking Antoinette and Ben. You have given us a lot of things to chew on, but there were a couple of quotes that you mentioned that were of particular interest, and I'd like to perhaps close today by asking you a question that derives from them. The first was the importance from the Medina report, the importance of investment capital. The wealth of America has been created in no small measure because of the abundance of investment capital and the willingness of capitalists to invest it. On the other hand, there is this competing tension that in a democracy, too much power is lodged in too few hands on Wall Street. This tension seems to be really at the heart of your book. And in your book, John Mack and some other strong and good people win. They're the good guys. They're wearing the white hats. But from what you know of Wall Street and the things that are going on there now, are there enough good and strong men and women to put some sort of self-regulation in place that will be effective to keep massive losses from occurring that damage the public markets? Or is this a situation where the other impulse, the too much power in too few hands, is going to lead to increased government regulation? Drawing lessons from the book, what do you see happening on Wall Street?
I'd say what it has already happened, that that overweening greed, unbelievable bonuses, the consequence of being of getting more and more money for selling less and less valuable instruments, has set up a situation where we're about to see a major turnaround. And I would say that I hadn't actually thought of this until you asked me this question, but I would say that in a way that Wall Street leaders now are a little bit like children who have behaved extremely badly and are hoping the grown-ups will come in and clean it up. And I don't think there's any question that we're going to see the same kind of reaction that we saw with when the Fed was established, when the SEC was established, Glass-Steagall, and so on, with new regulations specifically on hedge funds. One of the most important people I know on Wall Street in terms of his power and scope said to me, any one of 100 hedge funds could take down a Morgan Stanley. It was the hedge funds who withdrew from Bear Stearns who took down Bear Stearns. So I think that we will see regulation. I think that it's going to be a little bit too much in the same way that people feel that Sarbanes-Oxley went too far. And I think it'll probably slide over toward the center. But I expect that we'll, before the end of the Bush administration, we'll be seeing regulation on Wall Street that we hadn't seen before.
Pat Beard has very generously agreed to sign copies of her book, which will be on sale in our lobby following the forum. Thank you very much.
Thank you.